This is Ecotopia 197, The Forces of Nature. This week on Ecotopia, we'll be talking about Mother Nature. Nature is a powerful force that can bring destruction to human habitation. Nature is an element that can bring calm and contentment to human beings. In the first segment, we'll be talking with Barry Vann, who teaches at the University of Cumberland's, about his book, The Forces of Nature. In it, he explores the history and geography of natural disasters in the distant and recent past, and considers what may be in store for an increasingly populous planet. We pick up the interview just after we had asked Professor Vann to talk about some of the historic migration patterns that he has observed in his book.
Long before the Ice Age ended about 10,000 to 12,000 years ago, our ancestors had pretty well mapped out a migration route out of Africa and the Near East, around south, southern part of Asia, all the way down to Australia and New Zealand. And in many cases, they may have had semi-permanent villages, but we'll never know because when the Ice Age retreated, the ocean levels rose, and many of the Middle Eastern, Near Eastern flood myths probably originated from those kinds of events in which semi-permanent villages became flooded.
And you also remark in your book that we like waterfront property. We're attracted to lowlands and wet places.
Absolutely. You know, that, for hunters and gatherers, and then for farmers, those kinds of places offer a veritable cornucopia of foodstuffs. Flora and fauna are quite abundant in those places. They tend to be more moderate in temperature because they're closer to water bodies. And so as a consequence, life is better supported in those kinds of environments. And today we can see that, well, President John F. Kennedy even said that that there seems to be some natural inclination on our part to be drawn to the seas. He said when we go back to the seas, whether to watch it or to swim or to sail in a boat, we are going back to from whence we came, he would say. And so as a consequence, even today in California, San Francisco, real estate prices become much more exorbitant the closer you get to the Pacific Ocean.
Right. And what was it that led you to talk about the forces of nature? Is it recent events, or have you just always studied the history of how nature has worked on people?
Well, I have always sort of been interested in that topic. I guess as a young freshman, I walked into a classroom, and I've been a baseball player, and I walked into a classroom that was taught by Dr. Frank L.P. Charton, who had a Ph.D. from Michigan State University in physical.
So do I.
Really?
But not in his field. His field was what?
Physical geography.
Oh, okay.
He's a Spartan, so you're a Spartan too. That's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
So I walked into his classroom, and he was talking about the jet stream flying over Fenway Park in April, because he had been a Boston Red Sox baseball player.
Right.
And somehow or another that resonated with me, and that was nearly 30 years ago. So I've stayed with me, I guess. And to some extent, I've been working on that book ever since then. But I've written six other books, but this is by far my favorite.
So could you give us some examples of how you started with the flow of people in ancient civilizations, where they lived and how they lived? How did they cope with natural disasters? What kinds of natural disasters did they encounter, and what do we know about how they responded?
Well, we know that the climate was much different back in those days. It was a lot cooler and damper, more lush. In fact, in the chapter on, I think it was number 4, Geotheology from the Cradle of Civilization.
Yeah, we want to talk about that.
We looked at depictions of climate weather conditions back during the time of the writing of the Book of Job, which would have been somewhere around about 900 B.C. And it clearly delineates weather events that cause frozen rivers. Mm-hmm. And you don't see that too much in the Middle East now.
Mm-mm.
So clearly there was a much cooler and probably damper climate during those days, in which people probably would have found the environment difficult, if not challenging, but they stayed as close as they could to water bodies, especially mm-hmm. oceans. And again, in those areas, it's more moderate. Water bodies have a moderating influence on climate and weather over time, and so they probably would have stayed as close as they could to those places, which would have been really nice for them, too, because they would have found estuaries, and estuaries are places where fresh and mm-hmm. salt water mixed together, and those are breeding grounds for a lot of aquatic life and the animals that feed on them, so they would have done really well for themselves to stay in those areas and to use those as sort of a headquarters or semi-permanent villages to branch out and go off on foraging and hunting excursions, and then go back there and bed down for the night or the week. Now, we know that in Ireland, for example, there's a place called Mount Sandal up in County Antrim that was settled back around 7500 B.C., and flint taken from the river Ban has been found all over the Irish Sea area, and that would have been scattered about by hunters and gatherers from that particular location.
You also started to talk about geotheology. Often in earlier times, mm-hmm. people would say that natural disasters were the wrath of God, punishment misbehavior.
Yes. Yes, we really haven't changed a whole lot to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
The concept of geotheology was coined by a geographer by the name of John K. Wright, so I want to give him credit for that concept. But he didn't really come up with sufficient enough words to describe the idea that people believe that God uses the forces of nature to punish or even reward folks. So I came up with two new words. One's called geotheokalesis, that's earth, God, and punishment, and geotheomistosis, earth, God, and rewards. And then, of course, there are secular people today who discount the role of divine forces, but nevertheless, they see a benefit rewards, punishment rewards relationship with nature. And so just drop the theo part, and you've got geokolasis and geomistosis. And so a lot of people who are involved in the climate change debate, for example, probably gravitate towards geokolasis. Earth is trying to tell us something.
And what are some of the examples of, now I can't say it.
Theology?
Oh, no, the second term, geokolasis.
Yeah, the secular version.
The opposite version.
Yes, oh, geomistosis.
Yes, yeah. What are some examples?
Let's say that we reduce our carbon footprint.
Uh-huh.
And if we reduce our carbon footprint, then we're going to ameliorate the causes of global warming. And so we can have a much better life if we live in harmony with nature.
And Steve was right. I did want to ask about the geotheology. What are some examples that you've seen in either in history or in current days where people see God as making a judgment with weather conditions?
Well, the classic example, of course, would be in the Old Testament where Moses leads his people out of, well, not his people, but let's say Abraham. Abraham and Sodom and Gomorrah. Of fire and brimstone being hurled down upon the cities to destroy them for their iniquitous lifestyles. The great flood event, which is also talked about in the Epic of Gilgamesh, so it has probably some historicity to it beyond just a biblical source, but there is certainly a belief that God, of course, punished wayward people for living sinful lives. And then more recently, even people for example, Jerry Falwell, I believe it was, mm-hmm. was talking about some natural disaster was the consequence of sin. I think it was in New Orleans with Katrina, for example.
Mm-hmm.
If it wasn't Jerry Falwell, it was somebody else.
Well, I wonder if we could fast forward to more recent disasters. You spent a lot of time on disasters over the last century or two. I was particularly interested. You grew up in the Cumberland Gap area. You teach there at the moment, and you write at some length about the Tennessee Valley Authority as one example of humans' efforts to control nature, and then about some of the unintended consequences. Could you tell us that story, please, and how it illustrates some of your theses?
Well, in the Cumberland Gap area, actually, I put a little disclaimer out here. I actually grew up in Detroit, Michigan, but
Okay, didn't catch that.
But I do teach at the University of the Cumberland. I was born in East Tennessee, but like a lot of poor people, we went north to work and came back and so forth. But the Cumberland Gap in the Tennessee Valley Authority, in the local culture here, is really highly regarded. In fact, when I started writing that chapter, I thought, man, this is going to be awesome. You know, I'm going to get to talk about the Tennessee Valley Authority. It's going to be great. But the more I got into it, the more I realized that there were probably some other historical events that came into play with respect to precipitating this. It's history behind geography, not geography behind history. Now, if we look at the idea that erosion was the reason why they really wanted to build the dams and control the flooding that was taking place in the Tennessee Valley, that would have been all well and good. That would have been geography behind history. But the reality is that you have to go all the way out to the Great Plains in the Dust Bowl and to see who the players were behind the scenes. And really, George W. Norris, who was a senator from Nebraska, was heavily involved with President Roosevelt in bringing about TVA. And for a host of reasons, not the least of which was to create the Tennessee Valley Authority, which, by the way, was one of Roosevelt's 100 Days programs. But so was the Agricultural Adjustment Act, which was to limit the production of food to bring prices up to the 1916 levels. And so there are a whole host of political events that are going on behind the scenes that really kind of undermine the lifestyle of people who lived in the Tennessee Valley. They were never asked, do you want to relocate? This is the Great Depression. 25% of the population is unemployed. There are vagabonds and hobos traveling about America looking for work, and there are soup kitchens springing up in the Rust Belt. Well, there are people coming through on trains, getting off in East Tennessee, looking for food and looking for work, whatever they can find. Meanwhile, the government dispossesses 16,000 families from the most fertile bottomlands in the Tennessee Valley, at a time when there's no jobs to go to. And so a lot of those folks were up against it, and they became part of the unemployed masses. Mm-hmm. So I was interested in knowing what life was like for those people who weren't dispossessed, the people who lived in the more rugged uplands. And what I found was that they were really a self-sufficient people. And, in fact, I'd like to, if I could please, share with you just a little brief comment from a lady by the name of Jimmy Edwards, who grew up in the area during the 1930s, and she recalled this. She says, Mama canned everything she could get her hands on. We had a well and cistern, grew tomatoes, green beans, cucumbers, raised hogs and chickens. Beef was rare at our house. Daddy and my brothers brought in lots of squirrels and rabbits. We never went hungry. Our sweet tooth was satisfied by all the wild strawberries, blackberries, and mulberries that grew on the hillsides among the thickets. We'd go out and pick 2 gallons of them, and Mama would can some, and the others she would use to make a pie or dumplings. Now, that sounds like a pretty nice lifestyle to me.
I'm curious about, to what extent do you see natural disasters as natural, and to what extent are some of the disasters you're talking about caused by humans, their needs, the places they live? Can you sort of delineate that for me a little bit?
Sure. There are certain places that we make a lot of decisions about doing things that really set us up for problems. There are consequences. There is geochilasis that goes on. There are negative consequences to human environmental interactions. Case in point, Denora, Pennsylvania, 1948. 20 people died as a result of an air pollution disaster there.
Wow.
A couple years later, 4,000 people died in London, England, as a result of an air pollution disaster. What happened was you had a temperature inversion that came and settled in over London.
Mm-hmm.
A similar event happened in New York, by the way, around the same period of time, and 2,000 people died, where you had a temperature inversion that settled in, and all the emissions that were produced by factories and automobiles and other kinds of internal combustion engines were trapped. And so you had a lot of gases that were harmful to human respiration that were trapped there and caused these people to die. But we also make decisions about living in places where it may seem benign. For example, New Orleans. New Orleans is actually sitting below sea level. Part of it is, anyway. They don't bury the dead below ground. They bury them above ground because the water table's right at the surface. And so when Katrina came, the levees actually stopped what we call storm surge, but 12 inches of rain fell up in the Mississippi River Valley, and all that water went into the groundwater and the surface water, and it flowed towards the Gulf of Mexico, causing the water table to rise. And so water was rising behind the levees and under the levees and in front of the levees, and it just dissolved as a result of that. There's very little technology that we can do to stop the groundwater from rising. And so it was probably going to happen, and it's going to happen again at some point. May not be in the near future. It could be in 500 years. We don't know, but it's going to happen again.
Mm-hmm.
And then Galveston, Texas, the year 1900, long before anybody was talking about global warming, temperatures in September had been hovering around the 100-degree mark around Philadelphia and across the Midwest. And out in the Gulf of Mexico, it was super hot, and out in the Atlantic Ocean, it was super hot. So the most powerful hurricane probably to ever strike European-inhabited American shores happened on September 8, 1900, when 16,000, or as few as 8,000, we really don't know for sure because of conflicting reports, people died as a result of probably a Category 4, Category 5 hurricane that swept across the island of Galveston. And so people made the decision to live there. It may look tranquil, may look benign most of the time, but there are going to be instances in which nature changes scenario on people, and it can be very dangerous, very deadly.
Right.
Barry Van, your final chapter, is a vision of the Americas in 2060, not just America, the U.S., but the continent. You also talk about how the world might change, Africa, China, the Middle East, including standard of living, men's and women's roles, economic production. What's your best vision of how humans might think about natural disasters and living places over the next century, next half century or so, and make good decisions? What's a good vision for us?
Well, if you say a good vision in terms of the most accurate vision or the most optimistic vision, mm-hmm. those are two different things. This chapter is arguably the most controversial one in the book, and it's based on historical patterns, including demographic trends that I project into the future. You know, a good many observers believe that technology is going to allow the United States to continue to grow and prosper and flourish, but there are limits.
Mm-hmm.
There are limits to what we can absorb in terms of population immigration, and a lot of the places where people would move to are dangerous areas, like, for example, the Atlantic coast and the Gulf of Mexico, those are squarely in Hurricane Alley. They're also in areas where temperature inversions may occur, and you can have another pollution disaster like the ones that happened in Denora and New York City. We've also got water pollution issues, like, for example, the death of Lake Erie. And so if we have another adverse climatological or meteorological event compounded with land use practices that are not exactly conducive to sustainability of lakes, we could have another disaster like we did with Lake Erie. And so the more population pressure we place in the United States, the more potentially bad it could be, because there's going to be more pollutants and more refuse that's going to be put into the system that we have to deal with. Not only that, but probably the most difficult thing we have to consider is that some of the places that we think are safe, like, for example, from New Orleans up to Memphis and all the way up to St. Louis, that is a part of the Mississippi River Valley that actually covers the New Madrid Fault Line.
Mm-hmm.
In 1812, that particular part of the Earth's crust released the most devastating, perhaps arguably the most devastating earthquake that's ever struck North America. Buildings shook as far away as Charleston, South Carolina, and buildings were knocked down in Cincinnati, Ohio.
Fortunately,
there were very few people that lived there then, but today there's several million people that live there.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them are poor. A lot of them live in subsidized housing projects, and those are brick structures, and they're not built to withstand the shaking of an earthquake. The Midwest, which is a strongly agricultural area, and we have a lot of immigrants moving in from Latin America who don't have good English skills. And this is Tornado Alley. Every year there are 1,000 tornadoes touch down in the United States, and most of them occur in the Great Plains. And what are the implications for warning people who don't have good English skills and don't know where to go for safety? And do we have enough underground shelters to protect people? It's difficult to say.
It is.
Now, another problem we have is overpopulation in other parts of the world because of the patriarchal system, where men rule and women don't take part in social and political power. They really do produce more people than they can employ, and so as a consequence, they migrate, and they migrate to Europe, and migrate to North America. And as long as we allow that to happen, they're going to continue to live life the way they do. So the United Nations and other organizations really need to work with these countries to help them develop and modernize and empower women so that their situation can change and the world can be more sustainable.
We don't really have time to do the book justice. The arguments are complex, and we recommend it highly to our listeners. It's called The Forces of Nature, Our Quest to Conquer the Planet. It's published by Prometheus Books. Barry Vann also has a slideshow that's a short version of it. It's on Huffington Post as a blog, and we will put up the rather long link to that slideshow on our website, ecotopiakzfr.net. We want to thank you, Barry Vann, for being with us this evening and talking with us about the forces of nature.
Absolutely, my pleasure. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good night.
You are listening to Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 Chico, and on tonight's program, we are looking at the complex relations between people and their environment. Our guest with us on the phone now is Richard Louvre. He's written a book called The Nature Principle, Reconnecting with Life in a Virtual Age, published by Algonquin Books. In an earlier book, Last Child in the Woods, he created the now widely used phrase, nature deficit disorder, to describe the growing gap between kids and nature. And in this book, he says that adults suffer from nature disorder as nature deficit disorder as well. Welcome, Richard Louvre.
Well, thank you.
Can you tell us what nature deficit disorder is?
Sure. It's not a known medical diagnosis. Uh-huh. I work hard to make that clear in both books. It is, though, an easy way to talk about something that many of us intuitively know is true, and now there's science behind it, and there's kind of two bodies of evidence. One is the evidence that particularly kids, but all of us, because kids grow up to be adults, we've got the first essentially denatured generation of young parents right now. Not all of them, of course, but it describes the effects, really, of our alienation from nature. And again, these two bodies of research, one shows that the deficit is growing, but the other body of evidence is a growing number of studies that show just how great nature is, both for child development, but also for adult development. And the new book, The Nature Principle, is really more about adults. The first book, right. Last Child in the Woods, was more about kids.
Mm-hmm. And has this been coming for a long time, or have we just sort of started to see this disorder? And what's the evidence? What are you looking at when you say, oh, that person's got nature deficit disorder?
Yeah, well, a philosophical answer to that would be it started with the invention of agriculture, but as we moved away from hunting and gathering, and then the Industrial Revolution, of course, moved us further from nature. Sure. But within modern times, really the last 30, 35 years, it's been growing at an accelerating pace. Various estimates show that even within the last 5 years, the amount of time kids spend outdoors has dropped about 16%, possibly about 50% just in the last 20 to 25 years. And when you look at what kids are doing, that makes sense. The Kaiser Family Foundation found that kids are spending an average of about 54 hours a week plugged into some kind of electronic entertainment medium. And, that's more hours than many of their parents work. So it's more hours than they're in school.
And what are I was about to use the word symptoms, but you said it's not a medical disorder. But how do kids, and perhaps more relevant, adults, start to operate or behave once they disconnect from nature?
Well, I think, and by the way, even though it's not a known medical diagnosis, the medical world is paying some attention to it. In 2010, I was asked to be the keynote speaker to the American Academy of Pediatrics, their national conference, and I spoke to 5,000 pediatricians.
Wow, great.
And some of them now, the idea of prescribing nature is actually catching on, both in the UK and here and in other countries as well. In Portland, Oregon, for instance, the Portland Parks Department is working with local physicians who write recommendations or prescriptions to go outside in nature to the families they deal with. When they get home, the park department actually emails them or calls them and says, here's what we can do for you. The family goes to the park, gets their green exercise. The park ranger now acting as a park para health professional, helps them get that, signs off on the prescription and sends it back to the pediatrician. Over time, they're going to study how that works. But there's a long list of benefits: stress reduction, lower symptoms of attention deficit disorder. There's a lot that, both with children and adults, these benefits go on and on, and at least that's what this new body of evidence is suggesting strongly.
There must be attitude changes connected with this as well. If I just go to the park because my parents make me, or I feel it's a duty or will cure my ailments, I would guess it's not going to have very positive effects. What sort of change of mind and change of heart do people need to develop when they're going to go out into nature?
Well, first, not all of it has to be as much of a conscious decision as we think. I mean, it may well depend on the actual environment people live in. For instance, parks, urban parks that have the highest biodiversity also have the best impact on human psychological well-being. So that's just being around a park. You know, just a view from a window of trees seems to reduce girls' stress, for instance, young girls' stress. For some reason, it works best on girls. That's the University of Illinois studies, et cetera. You're right that, what attitude we bring to it really affects the outcome, probably. But a lot of this is innate. It's just who we are. It's our biological makeup. People in hospital beds who have a view of a natural scene and get better quickly, much quicker than people who have a view of a man-made environment. So it seems to be genetically programmed into us, and this is one of the reasons why it's so important to pay attention to this.
Why do you think Is it just easier for children to be on electronic devices and live in that virtual world? It just seems to me our granddaughters love being outside. That's their first choice of things to do. I mean, they're only two. But why do people gravitate toward that virtual world when they've got parks and, you know, playgrounds and forests and so forth?
One thing is you're assuming that they have parks and playgrounds.
Well, true.
Schools have been canceling recess and pulling back on outside activity, killing field trips. That's been going on for several years now. Urban parks in very urban neighborhoods are often very dangerous places. So even when nature is nearby, though, people, as you suggest, tend to make the decision not to go out into it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in terms of parenting, in terms of the kids, there are several reasons for this. One is they have a realistic fear of traffic, and
mm-hmm.
that comes from
mm-hmm.
bad urban design.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Also, they preach at us a lot. You know, we hear it a lot as parents: get your kids outdoors, or you go for a walk, etc. And in some of these neighborhoods, you have to ask, walk where?
Yeah.
I mean, these aren't well-designed neighborhoods. Some of the neighborhoods actually have essentially criminalized nature play for kids. One woman told me her community association outlawed chalk drawing on the sidewalks, just that. I mean, just try to put a basketball hoop up in some of these
mm-hmm.
neighborhoods, let alone let the kids build a fort or a treehouse. So, but beyond that is certainly the impact of electronics, which is there. I mean, these things, those games are fun. But also, most importantly, I think, is parental fear. We are mm-hmm. scared to death of stranger danger.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
So go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, no, I was just going to kind of extend that. So one of the things that we need is greater safety in neighborhoods, more parks in neighborhoods, urban redesign. I mean, there's a whole bunch of things we need to do to make nature accessible.
Yeah. We need to not wait for that, though. One of the chapters in the Nature Principle is about family bonding. This is an area there's not much research on. But when you think about it, it makes sense that if you really want to connect with your kid, it would be good to get away from the electronics, the TV, the
mm-hmm.
billboards, the
mm-hmm.
peer pressure, and just go for a walk in the woods with them and talk.
Mm-hmm.
Across the country now, something called family nature clubs are starting to spring
mm-hmm.
up. It's a little bit about how the book clubs spread a few decades ago and then became, you know, now there's thousands of book clubs. Some of these family nature clubs have hundreds of families as members. One has over 700 families.
Wow.
And essentially these are, you know, families who agree to show up on Saturday, not all 700 of them, but,
mm-hmm.
you know, five families at a time to show up at the park on Saturday and just go for a hike with their kids and
mm-hmm.
with each other. And that helps because there's perceived safety in numbers, and you don't have to wait for a foundation to,
right.
you know, to fund it, and you don't have
government.
To wait for urban design,
mm-hmm.
right?
You also write about the new nature movement. Is this a part of that movement, or is the new nature movement something separate?
It is a part of that movement.
Mm-hmm.
I make the argument, particularly in the paperback of the Nature Principle, because we added a new section at the end,
mm-hmm.
that environmentalism is in trouble. I mean, that's certainly not an original thought. When you look at many of the studies of environmental attitudes in the United States, you see that nature is being actually valued, or at least the environment is being actually valued less as time goes by in the last few years. It's almost as if, as environmentalists, the more we talk about climate change, the less people believe it. And I think there's two reasons for that. One is that we have forgotten how to talk about the future. I think in our culture, the images that most people carry around in their minds of the far future, even subconsciously, are images that look a lot like Blade Runner or
mm-hmm.
Mad Max.
Mm-hmm. I agree
Clockwork
with that.
Orange.
Yeah, right.
Yes.
And unless we have an alternative vision to that, and right now we don't. Environmentalism isn't providing it. Journalism isn't providing it. Politicians certainly aren't providing it. And I'm talking about a long-term vision of a good future, a great future, not just a sustainable future, you know, one that, you know, William McDonough, the great architect, likes to say, do you really want a sustainable marriage? Mm-hmm. Don't you want something even better than that?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
So I make the argument that we could have a nature-rich society. As of 2008, more people live in cities than in the countryside in the world. First time in human history, huge moment in human history. That means one of two things. Either the gradual disappearance of nature experiences from human life, and that means part of our humanity will go with it, or it means the beginning of new kinds of cities. I'd like us to start visualizing those, you know, wonderful cities that are nature rich, not just with parks, but in the way our homes are designed, the way workplaces are designed, using biophilic design, which has now been shown to increase productivity of workers, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, we could have a much better environment to live in if we bring nature into where we live, work, and learn, and play.
Are there models of biophilic design blossoming at the moment that you can tell us about?
And can you tell us what that is?
Pardon me?
And can you tell us what biophilic design is?
Oh, sure. Sorry. Well, biophilia is the biophilia hypothesis comes from E.O. Wilson at Harvard.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Basically, the idea is that we're hardwired to have an affiliation with nature. We need it. It's part of us. So biophilic design is the idea that when you, it goes beyond typical green architecture or green urbanism. When you design a building or a neighborhood or a city, you make sure that nature is in that design from the beginning and then kept there. Mm-hmm. Here's one example. It's not, there are examples of this around the country, around the world already existing, but one of the best hasn't been built yet, and I just saw the plans for it the other day. It was in William McDonough's office. William McDonough is kind of the Einstein of green design.
Mm-hmm.
And I visited him, spent the morning with him in his office. And I noticed an architectural drawing, and it really caught my attention. And it was a building that's being designed as it's a hospital in Spain, has three sides, multi-storied. One side is made up solid solar panels done in the colors of a butterfly that's about mm-hmm. to go extinct in that region. The other mm-hmm. side is a green wall, and then the third side is a vertical farm that will feed people in the hospital. So here's an example of a hospital that's not only saving energy, but taking the next step of creating human energy in several ways. But it doesn't stop there. The bottom floor of this hospital is all glassed in. Anybody who walks into that hospital, butterflies will light on them. The butterfly that's about to go extinct unless we bring it back. They're going to turn the bottom floor of the hospital into a butterfly factory. And every week they're going to open the doors, the butterflies will go out into the community. But they're not even stopping there. They're going to the local churches and synagogues and mosques saying, you can do this too, local businesses, local schools, local homes, and saying, we can all do this. We can bring this butterfly back. See, that's the kind of architecture that's not only energy efficient, it goes way beyond that to the point where it's actually creating, in a sense, nature.
Right. And that's one of the biophilic design is one of the seven major ways you talk about that in which people can connect or reconnect with nature. Another one is the hybrid mind. Can you say something about that?
I want to make clear, and I try to make clear in the nature principle, that I'm not anti-tech. I'm actually talking to you on a phone.
Yeah, exactly.
On the radio.
Right.
Yeah. And I'm looking at my Macintosh, so it's kind of hard to be high-tech. Anti-tech mm-hmm. these days.
And biophilic design wouldn't exist without technology.
That's right. That's right. And what we know is that technology does do things for us in terms of our ability to learn and create and all of that. The Internet is terrific in many ways. That enhances our lives to a degree. When it's overdone, it begins to drain our lives. But when we're out in nature, there's a different effect. First, it calms us and relaxes our mind from the use of technology. I mean, that's what some of these studies are showing, is the best way to avoid the burnout from looking at a computer screen too long is to go outside into nature. But it does other things, too. Scientists who study the human senses no longer talk about five senses. They talk about as many as 30.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
And many of these are really accentuated when you go outside in nature. And if you don't do that, if you're staring at a computer, most of our lifestyle these days, we focus on blocking out our senses, or many of them, mm-hmm, in order mm-hmm. to concentrate. Mm-hmm. The best way I can describe the hybrid mind is I met a guy who trains people how to become pilots of cruise ships. And he said he gets two kinds of students. One kind grew up on couches playing video games, computers, et cetera. He said, they have a great talent that I need. They're great at the electronics, got a lot of electronics on the ship. The other kind of student mainly grew up outside. And that student, who had a lot of experience in nature, he said, they also have a great talent. They actually know where the ship is. And he wasn't being facetious.
No.
He was being literal. There actually is a whole set of senses that have to do with where we are in space, mm-hmm. our knowledge of where we mm-hmm. our positioning is. But the full use of the senses is what is brought to that. He said the ideal student to him would be a student who comes to him with both sets of abilities, both the abilities right. that electronics gives him, but also this set of abilities that being out in nature more provides. That to him would be the ultimate student, and that to me should be one of the ultimate goals of modern education.
Yes.
Richard Louv, a question we often ask on our guests on this program: what's your degree of optimism that people can or will make the changes in education, in their attitudes, in their practical habits? Are you optimistic?
I like to quote Ray Bradbury, who I interviewed a few years ago, who said that he was neither an optimist nor a pessimist. He described himself as an optimalist.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, optimizing, doing the best we can with what we've got. And that's a little different stance. I think that I'm by nature more optimistic than some folks, but it all depends on how we begin to talk to ourselves about the future. And that mm-hmm. is in some ways where this new nature movement comes in, because it brings health into the conversation. It brings cognitive functioning benefits of nature into it. It brings a vision of great new cities and a great new way of life into it. It's a much bigger table to sit at right. on than the current environmentalism.
Right. Where can our listeners go to learn more about the nature principle and related ideas? For example, you have 20 things that people can do to become more nature, to bring nature into your life. Where can they learn more about this?
Well, there's a couple places. I write my blog on two sites. One is my own site, which is the easiest way to remember that is natureprinciple.com.
Mm-hmm.
But the other side is the Children and Nature Network, which I co-founded, and that's at childrenandnature.org, and it's a nonprofit that is forwarding the cause of the movement to reconnect kids to nature.
And there's also a free online field guide to the new nature movement. Is that on your website or on your?
A short version of it is on the Children and Nature Network
okay.
website, but
okay,
a long version, it is pretty long, lots of resources, is on the natureprinciple.com.
Okay, great.
That one I found especially filled with info for somebody who seriously wants to look at it. That's the bibliography to look at. We will post all of those links on our website as well, ecotopiakzfr.org. We want to thank you, Richard Louv, for being with us tonight. The book is The Nature Principle, Reconnecting with Life in a Virtual Age. It's published by Algonquin Books. Excellent, helpful read. Thank you, Richard, for being with us this evening.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for what you do, too.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Songs for everyone.
You've been listening to Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 Chico. Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR members and by EcoCab, Chico's green alternative taxi service. EcoCab provides safe, reliable transportation 24 hours a day in a new fuel-efficient Toyota Prius. Protect the planet and get where you need to be with EcoCab. The cab that cares. Call 591-3186.
And coming up at 7 this evening on KZFR is The Storyteller with Adrian Scott and Julie Nielsen, bringing you stories, legends, and music and from long ago and modern day cultures. Join them for a trip around the world exploring the hopes, fears, and dreams that are universal to all people.
And at 7:30, host Senor Felipe serves up East L.A. Cholo, soul, R&B, oldies, blues, doo-wop, Latin, folk, and gospel. And social commentary and interviews with interesting members of the community. L.A. Sounds takes you back home to the roots where it all began. Back on the block, come on home with Senor Felipe. Thank you for listening to Ecotopia. I'm Susan Chudy.
And I'm Stephen Chudy. Contact us at ecotopiakzfr@gmail.com. We're always eager to hear from you, suggestions for shows. Also visit our website, which is one of the world's great sites for high school term papers, ecotopiakzfr.net. You can also become our friends on Facebook and receive advance notice of upcoming shows. Thanks for listening.
Weave me the sunshine out of the falling rain.